All right, well, let's get started. Good morning, everybody. My name is Carrie Bickner Zeldman, and I am with the New York Public Library, and you are in Preserving Our Digital Legacy and the Individual Collector, and thank you so much for coming. I'm just going to introduce the panel very quickly, and I'm really excited about this group because we're going to look at digital preservation and the importance of what you all produce and how it's going to exist or not exist in the historical record from a few different points of view. This is Bill Stingone, my colleague from the New York Public Library, who's the curator of manuscripts at NYPL. Josh Greenberg, right here, is an assistant professor at the George Mason University Center for New Media Studies, and he is sort of a hybrid humanist and gearhead. He's hard to describe. But one of the things that I like about him is he did his PhD dissertation at Cornell in sciences and technology on the history of the VCR and sort of the social impact of the VCR. So he's going to look at this from a socio and sort of technological point of view. And then my new colleague, Megan Wingett from UT Austin, is an assistant professor there, and she's been looking at digital preservation of not just records, but from an art historical point of view. And if you Google her, you'll see some of her articles about how to preserve email. So from you know, the scholarly to the practical. And I think what I'll do is I'll just start us off with a tragic little story. And we're going to end optimistically, so I don't feel like too bad about being a downer. How many of you have ever read Zora Neale Hurston, Like Their Eyes Were Watching God? Okay, how many of you saw the miniseries with Halle Berry? That counts too. No one. Good. This is a good audience. So Zora Neale Hurston was the queen of the Harlem Renaissance, and she was a great writer, and she was also a great folklorist. But like many in her generation, she died in obscurity, and she died in poverty. 10 years after her last major publication, and 15 years before she was rediscovered by our generation. And when she died, she was living in a small town of poor black people in Florida. And as was the practice in this town, if you die and nothing's meant, no indications are made about how to handle your estate, your stuff's just burned up. So all of her manuscripts, her letters, all of her materials were just put out on her cement porch and lit by some community officer who was responsible for this. Well, the sheriff who was on duty that day, Sheriff Patrick Duvall, saw the plumes of smoke rising and thought, oh, I wonder who died, and you know, drove up to see who it was and realized at once that it was his friend Zora Neale Hurston. And he'd read her as a young man and knew that this was a literary giant. So he jumped out of his police cruiser, ran to the fire, started pulling things off the fire with his bare hands and putting out the flames with his hands. Actually, when he died, he had scars all over his hands. So what he did is he saved the manuscript from her last book. He saved many of her correspondence, and then brought them home to his house. His wife said, "You can't bring that heap of garbage into my house." He left it on the front porch for 2 years and called libraries and archives around the country for 2 years until he could find someone to take the collection in. And eventually it made its way to the University of Florida, Gainesville. Now we look at her materials for a number of reasons. Zora Neale Hurston was a difficult person to pin down, and she had different ways of presenting herself to different audiences. So you really need to go back to her primary sources to kind of decode her life and figure out what she was really up to. It's especially important when you look at her work as a folklorist, because she drove around the South gathering folklore, but by the time it was published, it was so heavily edited by her patrons and her publishers that you're not really sure what her original intentions or her original findings were. So her manuscripts are like a really important part of our historical record. The reason I'm starting with this is because I think there's a big difference between paper and digital formats. Paper can sit on a front porch for 2 years, and it can withstand fire, heat, humidity. But I don't think that's going to be the case with digital records. And because we're in a field that's still relatively new, we're in a field where we don't know who's going to be important 50 years from now. But we're at a conference where I think many of you are the people who are going to want to research 50 years from now, 100 years from now. And I think that your output is at risk for being lost. And the reason we're talking about the individual collector is because I think it's going to sometimes take, and my colleagues are going to disagree with me on this, and I invite that, but I think it's going to take somebody like Deputy Sheriff Patrick Duvall or yourselves managing your own collections well to preserve your output, your intellectual, your creative output, until there's a time when our field sort of enters the larger canon of history. So what I'm going to do is open this up for some questions, and what I'm going to do is start just with just the nature of the stuff. What kinds of objects are we talking about? How durable are they? And Megan, one of the things that you know we often hear about is, like, let's say you've got your family portrait, your family photo album, and you don't know what to do with it, and someone will say, "Why don't we just scan it and put it on a CD, and that'll be." And then we'll be done with it. We'll have preserved our family photo albums. Well, why? What's the problem with that? And what are digital records like? And what kind of care and feeding do they need to make it for the long haul?
Right. Well, digital records are by default ephemeral. They decay immediately upon creation, pretty much. And as opposed to paper or wood or rocks, you know, like clay tablets. Digital documents need technology to mediate between the document and the thing that you're looking at. And this is commonly called the viewing problem. Is this a complete review for everybody in the room? No. Okay, so the viewing problem says that you need technology to read digital documents. And there are three kinds of ways to fix this problem. One is called refreshing, the next is called migration, and the third is called emulation. So refreshing is when you say you have some documents on a 5-inch floppy disk, and then you transfer those documents to a 3-inch floppy disk, and then you transfer those documents to a flash drive, and then you transfer them to a network drive, and then you transfer them to whatever drive is necessary in the future. That's called refreshing. Migration is related to the software. So it's difficult to open documents more than two iterations prior to the software version that you are on now. So it's difficult, for example, to open a Word 97 document at this point. And it's almost impossible to open a WordStar document, if anybody remembers that. It's possible to do it, but you're changing it when you open it. And whether that's important or not is dependent on your needs for opening the document. So migration would be that you open a document that was created in WordPerfect, and you migrate it to Word 2.0, and then you migrate it to Word 5.0, and then you migrate it to Word 98, to Word 2000, to Word XP. So this is okay when you've got one document, but when you have 10,000 documents, you can probably write some sort of program that's going to open all the documents and save them in a different file, and then open them again and save them in a different file. But it's a little bit ham-fisted, really. And unfortunately, it's kind of the only fix that we have right now. Not only is it ham-fisted and inelegant, but it changes little tiny pieces of it. You know, say the font isn't the same, or the layout isn't the same, or you know, Word doesn't handle tabs the same way that WordPerfect does. For lots of documents, that doesn't make any difference at all. But for a lot of other kinds of documents, it makes a really big difference. And then the final fix for the viewing problem is emulation, which is based on building software that will emulate an older version of the software. So you, for example, build a box that is OS 10 50 years from now. And it can run all of the applications that were created for OS 10. But and this is kind of nice because you can, you know, get whole bunches of software to run on this one thing. So all you have to do is build this one thing. The problem with that, and one of my research interests is new media art, so not just email or not just documents, but actual art, is that with art, if you make any change whatsoever, you are changing the art. And with emulation, you're essentially running an OS 10 box on a machine that runs OS 30. And the OS 30 has a much higher processing speed, it has a much different kind of aspect ratio, it has different kinds of monitors, everything will be different. But you're running the old your old OS X on this really super duper fast machine, and it's going to make your thing, your entity, your game, whatever, run faster, for example. So, in a lot of cases, if we're just talking about documents, that is a non-issue. You know, nobody cares if a document opens faster. But if you're talking about something where there's interaction happening or there's some sort of data coming in from the network and it's coming in faster and things are happening too quickly, then you have made a significant change to the document. So those are the problems with really basically in a nutshell, problems with digital preservation. And just one other point that I wanted to make is that a lot of the problem with emulation and, well, emulation specifically, is that if you're not using an open source product, then you are unable to screw around with the product to make it do what you want it to do. And so, for example, say at the last South by Southwest I came to, Josh Davis was the Will Wright-ish sort of speaker, and the last person to talk before everybody got on the plane and left. And he was selling his hard drive. He had like burned his hard drive to disk and was selling it for $20 or something. And I bought it, and he had stuff on, like it was just his hard drive, but it had all of his Flash 2 files. And I cannot run Flash 2. Like, I have these disks that are Flash 2, and there is no way for me, as a normal person at least, to access those files and read them and read the lingo and see what he's doing. And that is because Flash is a proprietary system. If he had written it in, say, C++ or Java, then I would at least be able to read the code. But as it is now, I can't even read the code. Mm-hmm. And so the software issue is not only offensive from a free rights sort of perspective, but it's also really problematic from a preservation perspective. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to put that out there too.
Yeah, and I think too, I'll put out a question for the audience to think about. Maybe we could get some responses in the Q&A. And a way to test your intuitions about migration and emulation and what these files are going to look like 50, 100 years from now is to imagine if you had to curate an exhibition about the history of the web, what would you want to include and how would you want it to display? So if you could just tuck that away, and we'll think about that. And then I'm going to make kind of a left fork too and go back to Bill, who's responsible already for digital archival collections that are already born in digital formats before the big issues of migration and emulation are worked out. And one of the things that you acquired recently was the September 11th Foundation, right? Maybe you could speak about that in terms of what Megan was saying. Or whatever you want.
The September 11th Fund was established 2 or 3 days after September 11th, and they had a big benefit. It was on television, lots of rock stars performed it. They raised something like $100 million in 3 days. And their goal was to set up services and give out grants to help people who were affected directly or indirectly by the events of September 11th. So they approached us in about 2003 as they were winding down their business. So they'd only been in business for 2 years, and they wanted to give us their records. Their records, I don't know how much I should get into definitions, but what we collect are the records of organizations and the papers of individuals, usually of some note, who've done something that we want to document for historians to study later on. Being operating between 2001 and 2003, most of their records, all of their records, were actually in electronic format. And it was the first donor or potential depositor with us that had a collection that was completely and nothing but born digital. So we batted around a lot of different issues in discussing with them. They had very large databases that were shared over different spaces and different institutions. They had lots of legal agreements with the people whose information was in those databases. And they also just had a network in which people had very informal folders in which they just threw all their documents. We eventually ended up, their office manager, when all was said and done, handed me a CD with 500 megabytes of files on them. And unfortunately, one of the things that he did is he sort of reorganized them for my benefit. So we've already violated one archival rule of original order. But the challenge has been, well, I mean, there's many challenges that Megan has articulated, but one of the things that we're hoping to do is we use it because it is a relatively small collection and it is relatively, we could still open all the files, or most of them as far as I can tell, but there are, I think, about 50 different formats just in those 500 megabytes, and that's the thing that when I talk to people in IT or the digital library unit, they sort of roll their eyes because they want me to give them 5,000 of the same format so they could do one big migration or conversion or whatever we do. I should go back a little bit and say, I mean, we've been collecting born digital material probably for about 20 years without really knowing it, but it's been a little pathetic. You could if you go to our website and look at some of our archival finding aids, you might find some box list that says, you know, box 5, folder 2, 5-inch floppy disk. We literally just put it in a folder as if it was a piece of paper and put it in a box, and I don't, you know, and we might need to go back and revisit those things.
With all of our sooner than manpower, later, right?
It might be too late. So one of the challenges we still face, you know, we have the thing, we have these files backed up in many different places. We don't really have a system at the library yet that, or a long-term plan for how we're going to preserve even just the bit stream. And I'm looking forward to attacking the issue of the readability, how we're going to convert these things so researchers can actually look at these records. But we're still pretty much in a holding pattern, and many archival repositories around the country are in that same holding pattern. So we're, in a way, I feel, talking about more, this seems pretty mundane, and I actually think we could do it, as opposed to some of the things that you're talking about in terms of things that exist in time and things that are very dependent on the original format they were in for their meaning. I think we can, with textual documents, we can probably deliver what researchers want 50 years
right.
from now,
right.
more so. So I'm actually feeling more optimistic, you know, talking with you guys, yeah, than I was when, you know, when I got here a few days ago.
That's good.
But I like the September 11th example, because Josh has talked about this too. We think of our time now as being so well documented. I mean, if you wanted to document September 11th or the war on terror or Katrina, everyone's got a digital camera and everybody has a mobile device, and we have, you know, people on the streets becoming de facto reporters. But one of the things that we're kind of revealing here is that there's so much data now, and there are so many objects relating to our period in history, but they might not last. And I know, Josh, this is something that you're really interested in too, and you're interested in the amateur collector. And I'm kind of, I guess, lumping the person on the street taking a picture of these activities. So maybe you could talk about that, which is a different kind of collection from the work Bill's talking about.
Yeah, definitely. Actually, to interject one thing, just a note on this first, it may seem that new media art is a bit more esoteric than the stuff of day-to-day experience, text and images, et cetera. But increasingly, you know, the lived experience on the web is much more complex than a simple HTML page being loaded and rendered in a browser. We'll leave aside the rendering problem because, you know, how browsers would deal with things down the road, you know, that's emulation or migration. But one of the examples I like to give is 50 years from now, there's going to be a graduate student who's going to want to write about this interesting emergence of using geography and maps to visualize information that happened in the very, very early 21st century. Because it's a fascinating thing that we're seeing right now. And think about the materials that student is going to have to write that dissertation. We're not going to have an archive of what a Google Maps mashup looks like and is like to use, because it's not just a matter of crawling the page and sucking down the data. You would have to figure out how do you archive the server that's pulling in various pieces, often data from different servers, different online places. excuse me, how do you deal with archiving dynamic websites, especially now that they're pulling in data on the client side via AJAX and other technologies. So it's just that, you know, it starts to look a lot more like the new media performance art problem as opposed to the word processing document problem. Mm-hmm. So Carrie, on your question, so I come at this kind of from a different perspective. I'm a researcher. First and foremost, I'm a historian, though it's sometimes I feel like I'm passing as a historian because I come out of an interdisciplinary background. At the Center for History and New Media, we are humanists first and then technologists second. And so we're motivated by, you know, how do we get the materials that we want to use to write history, to do the scholarly research that we want to do. And we have a very public history orientation, understanding that it's not just academics in sort of a high tower who are doing research and writing history. It's public historians, it's amateur historians, it's a whole spectrum of shades of gray of people who are trying to gather materials and synthesize them and write a narrative or try to make sense of them. And so on this topic, one of the big questions that I have that we've been sort of intimately concerned with at CHNM is this work is going on. I wrote a dissertation on the history of VCRs in the video industry. I went out and I talked with a ton of people and who opened their personal collections to me. And I know tons of people who have amazingly rich resources, which aren't going into an archive, whether because of lack of interest or much more likely lack of resources. You know, there's only so much that institutions can do. And so in this era when we're reorienting towards sort of bottom-up grassroots kind of solutions to really massive problems, I'm interested in thinking about how collectors, individual sort of non-institutional collectors like me, I'm collecting for certain reasons, like you all who are, you know, every time you get an email and you put it in a folder, you're collecting it, in a sense. Every time you organize, you know, if you put stuff on your hard drive, you're creating your own personal collection. Traditionally, an archivist would come in and organize, you know, you would hand it off to them and they would, you know, handle it from there. But the sheer scope of materials is getting to a point where it seems that maybe either those of us who are in between, like me, like amateur historians, et cetera, or actual historical actors, you know, participants, can start to play a role in that. We've been thinking about this from most of the infrastructure, you know, like we were saying, the question of infrastructure is starting to get solved. There are very large, robust systems that can store bits for long periods of time. Things like, you know, DSpace, Fedora, you know, there are these very, very large, incredibly robust systems that are sort of the equivalent of the climate-controlled archival room that makes sure that paper doesn't degrade. But we've been approaching this from the perspective of, for those of us who don't have access to those systems, who don't have the apparatus to maintain them, what is the sort of lightweight, you know, web app solution? What is the WordPress that would allow you to create an archive quickly, get it out there, get something up, allow yourself, allow others to contribute. Two of my colleagues from George Mason are here, Jeremy Boggs and Nate Agrin, and they're two of the developers who've been building the system that we've been calling Omeka in-house that hopefully will release and put out an open source and let other people play with it from there. And that just grew out of a lot of projects like this that we were doing as historians, realizing we've got to work to digital library standards, but that kind of, if we don't get in there sooner, some of the stuff is going to go away before the larger institutions can get to it.
Hmm. Well, and that kind of gets me to the two next questions that I've got. And I'm thinking about this group in particular, about what it is you need to save and how to go about saving it. And when you think about what it is you need to save, I'm reminded of the document that we display at the library every 4th of July. We have a copy of the Declaration of Independence in Thomas Jefferson's own hand, and it's actually a penultimate version of the Declaration of Independence. And what he's done is he's written down to four of his friends, he's transcribed the penultimate version of his document. In it is language that, had it been ratified would have ended slavery in the United States earlier than it in fact was ended. And so he's underlined all this material, and you can tell by his handwriting that he's really mad, and he sent it to four of his friends, and one of these letters made its way into the collection of amateur historian, and then into our collections. And I think that letter, in a lot of ways, is more important than the actual Declaration of Independence, because it shows you how messy the process was. It reminds you that it was a committee making a decision, and in some cases they made bad choices. So it's like all of the, sometimes the iconic stuff that you think you might want to save, like your very best webpage, it's probably not what historians are going to be interested in. It's the stuff that you create along the way that people are going to really want. So I always think of the Web Standards Project, just because a family ties to the project. But the WASP webpage, for example, is really important because it sort of will give you the milestones of what happened. But if you really want to understand the process, what you're going to need is the email and the listservs and the fights and the, oh, did you see what she was wearing at South by Southwest kind of emails that are going to tell historians what actually unfolded. So I guess
that's what we really, really want.
Yeah, right. So, and Bill, maybe you could talk about the nature of evidence in an archival collection and what it is you really want to save, because you know future researchers are going to want.
Carrie mentioned that some of us might dispute her idea of the importance of the individual collector. As someone who collects personal papers and organizational records, I actually try to avoid collectors as much as I possibly can, and I want to go to the source. I want to go to the record creator or the historical actor, so that I want the records that they created unconsciously in the course of doing what they do, as opposed to, and this is a very hard thing even in the non-digital world to even get important people to understand. I'll go into someone's house to look at their papers, and they'll show me their scrapbooks of all the clippings about themselves, and then some brochures that they collected, and I'll say, well, where are your letters? It's like, oh, well, you don't want those. And that's exactly what I want. What I see in this environment is sort of an opportunity is that I want people to keep records as opposed to collect records, I guess, if I can make that distinction.
Yeah.
And I do see there's an opportunity in this environment. I think people sort of keep more records unconsciously than they actually used to. I mean, they don't take up as much space in your house or your porch. And they don't, and you also don't, in many cases, don't actually have to file them, because fortunately, most operating systems are sort of filing your things for you without your even knowing it. I mean, the problem is that they can go away much more quickly and easily just by basically neglecting to do anything with them, or you get a new computer and they're all gone. So what I'm hoping is that somehow be able to educate historical actors and creators to the kind of materials that we're interested in. The problem is we have to get to them much earlier than we used to, because we have to make sure that they haven't gone through 7 laptops before they realize, or we realize, that they're important. And in a way, that's always been sort of a problem, but it's everything becomes a little more urgent now. Mm-hmm. Things are getting a little blurry in terms of what people create and what they collect. And I don't want to get into that distinction, but it is a problem that we're having. And even Josh and I talking, and you might want to say more about this, have been more or less, but we haven't come to any conclusions about what that difference might actually be.
Yeah.
One thing that I think is actually, one of those points raised for me was, is that it's this point that a lot of the really important material is the process. It's not just the end result, it's the process. And one way to try to capture the process, or at least not discard process stuff, is to have tools automatically log it. There's something really promising to me in wikis, in versioning. The idea that historians of software development, if they have access to, say, a versioning repository for a site that's being built, and you can look at the process by which one piece was built, another was built. That's incredibly rich, valuable stuff, and that's a system where in the day-to-day work that you know people are engaged in, they're creating historical traces that are useful to them, you know, as more and more the kinds of things we do rely on this kind of versioning, particularly things in the kind of like digital web work space. But it's also, these things are unbelievably promising to historians down the road, although we don't really have a sense, there isn't a notion yet that when you complete a project that you'd maybe want to think about donating that repository somewhere, or just the path of once it's served its immediate purpose to you, what do you do with it, where does it go? That's where there, you know, some more linkages with the institutions that can that really are maintaining these long-term, you know, climate-controlled rooms for bits can help.
One of the things that I like about Megan's work, too, is you've looked at this problem from a couple of different points of view. You've looked at it in art history, and you've looked at it in the sciences. And I think that you, in some of the behavior that you've observed with artists in long ago and today, and some of the behavior with scientists, is this... sometimes attention to process and preservation, and sometimes a real ignorance of the value of what you're actually creating. So I wonder if you could speak, especially about the science stuff you were telling us about earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, one of the interesting things about new media art to me is that it's created by people who aren't necessarily artists in the traditional sense. So very often, I'm thinking about a piece called The Listening Post, which is by Mark Rubin and John Hansen, I think. And one of them is a statistician at Bell Labs. And he was doing all this stuff to doing some mining the internet. And they turned this into a piece of art. And if you come up later, I can tell you more about it. But artists, new media artists, are very often scientists. And they, or web designers, or graphic designers of some sort, and then they sort of turn into they turn into doing aesthetic things. So just to say that, and this is just to say that my interest in science and art is not so far afield as it might seem. But this idea of preserving your digital documents is changing, because in the past you would sort of get your documents of you know, running your business, and you'd put them in a file, and then when they weren't useful anymore, you'd put them in a box, and then you'd put the box into a closet. Like, this happens over years' time. And then somebody would come and, like, move the box from the closet to a warehouse somewhere. That's what records management is. And now it's much more dependent on individuals making decisions along the way about what they're going to save and how they're going to save it, and, you know, if they're going to file it or not file it, or digitize it in some cases. And so I've done some research on self-archiving. That's what that's called, self-archiving. And then eventually the idea is that some institution will take this stuff from you and deal with it. Whether that be like a university archives or whether it's the New York Public Library, you know, it just depends on who you are. So I was interviewing a scientist about his lab notebooks, and he you know, was a neuroscientist, and he works on ALS, which is a very difficult disease. I mean, it's Lou Gehrig's disease is the common name for it, and. He had a good career, you know, a good solid career at UNC, and but he had a lot of negative findings, you know, like this didn't work, this didn't work, this didn't work, this made no difference. And those are very difficult to publish. So he was interested in writing a narrative of his career, talking about all of his, you know, positive findings, but also his negative findings, so that future researchers could go and do the right thing, like start from where he left off, so they wouldn't have to have the negative findings. And so that was, first of all, the most important thing for the archive for him, was his narrative of his career, which is interesting. Like, it was an interesting finding that's what he thought was the most powerful thing. And we were looking at his lab notebooks, and I was like, oh, let's get your lab notebooks too, you know, just for kicks. And he's like, oh no, you may not have my lab. Those are totally a waste of time. There is no reason for you ever to digitize anybody's lab notebooks. And I was like, oh, come on, come on, let's just do one, you know, just for kicks. I'm doing it, you know, like, it's not even your time, it's my time. No, no. And the thing is that lab notebooks are what the archivists want, you know, and I could not convince him, I couldn't even convince him to let me have them, you know, like, my time, me digitizing, me ingesting, me making metadata. He was just like, this is totally useless. And that is really troubling to a lot of archivists when I tell this story at conferences, because he is in charge of that. And in the past, it was just a piece of paper that he thought was useless and he didn't care anything about. And, you know, okay, I'll put it in a box and then I'll put the box in the closet. Now he actually has to, you know, it's all digital now, so he has to download everything, put it on CDs, put the CDs somewhere safe, and, you know, and make sure they're organized in some way that is meaningful to him. And it's not like this denigration of lab notebooks is common. I think it is common within academia, but in industry, lab notebooks are the piece of intellectual property. They prove first discovery, or prior discovery, whatever the legal term is. They prove, you know, intellectual property. Lab notebooks are guarded with your life. They have very serious methods by which you collect information and then save that information. There's daily backups, nightly backups. So this is not, you know, archivists saying lab notebooks are important. They are important. And so that's my story about lab notebooks. Yeah, they are important. Yeah. So things that you think are completely mundane and no one is going to care about them, it's just not true.
And the part about the narrative is especially interesting. I don't know, I can't tell you how many donors say, I'm going to give you my papers. And you know what? I can come in and like explain them to you. And we said, well, that's not really necessary and that's not really the point. Or they want to describe their records for the public. And they want to write the story, and it's like, well, the records are the story, and they're going to be interpreted, hopefully, if they're rich, 1,000 different ways over the history. So I always, or they'll call me up and say, well, you know I should probably think about how I should organize my papers or records to give them to you eventually. How should I do that? And I say, just do your thing. You know, keep things where you need them to be for operational reasons or legal reasons, mm-hmm. and keep them that way, and that's the way I want them. You know, I don't want them organized into subject order before you give them to me, and I don't want you to write to me what they mean or for future researchers. And I think that's the hardest thing to get through to people, and that's why this sort of unconscious, you know, collection record keeping that, you know, automation might provide the potential for is intriguing, because we can have people stop worrying about what means what, and just we could just take it all in and worry about that later.
Right. So it's kind of funny though, you're talking about just letting the organization be organic and as you want it, but the act of actually preserving the stuff has to be much more active than it used to be with paper. Like you mentioned the example when you get a new computer. I mean, and this happened to me, the first couple of computers I had, when I got a new computer, everything that was on it just, I'd printed everything out. So I didn't need the stuff that was on the box. Josh, what comes to mind when I'm thinking about people's reluctance to turn certain kinds of records over to archives is the issue of privacy too. I mean, if I were to turn my email over to a repository now, there's a lot of stuff that I just wouldn't want to have read. And how have you seen in your work or developed ways of preserving a collection or maybe providing particular kinds of access to a collection, but then keeping restrictive material in an environment where people can't get to the private stuff?
Mm-hmm. Probably a good example of that is a project that I'd been involved in as a sort of advisor and working on a particular chunk of it. So the Library of Congress has been interested in this general problem of you know, how do you save digital stuff? You know, what does that system look like? The big initiative has been called NDIP, the National Digital Information Infrastructure and Preservation Program. I think I got the acronym right. I get the I's flipped sometimes. So one of those projects was the brainchild of a historian. It's mostly library and information scientists who've been working intently on building these architectures, building these systems. And then there's this one project, one of the initially funded ones, which is a historian named David Kirsch, who's at the University of Maryland, who has been interested for quite a long time in technological failure, in things that don't succeed. He wrote a dissertation on the history of the electric car and talked with a lot of people about electric cars and why in early 20th century we went with internal combustion as opposed to electric. You'll have to forgive me on the chronology, but a few years ago, he's in the business school at the University of Maryland and has been thinking a lot about the first sort of dot-com boom and bust and sort of what happened to a lot of those companies. And he saw mentioned in the newspaper that Brobeck, one of the big law firms that had handled IPOs in the Bay Area, had gone bankrupt. They had actually, you know, legally ceased to exist. And the historian in him said, you can think about this as almost an individual collector, the historian in him said, my God, their records are one of the best records of this moment in history. And, you know, instinctively, so like that day he booked a plane ticket, hoofed it out to the bankruptcy trustee's office and said, look, while you're figuring out how to untangle this huge mess, hire me as an unpaid consultant so I can help you not lose the digital record. You know, let's at least deal with the legal questions about what this material is, who's allowed to view it, who's not. But in the meantime, let's make sure it doesn't die. It doesn't go away. And ultimately, this project that was funded by the Library of Congress was really about figuring out how do you deal with materials that are sensitive? I mean, these are legal records. You don't really get more sensitive than that. They're also unbelievably important historical records. And so one of the questions is, 150 years from now, do you want these around? Is there a sense that if you're not legally allowed to look at them now, is there a sense that maybe 150 years from now, norms about attorney-client privilege may change? Norms, you know, you don't know. And if they go away, you know, you wind up in this sort of tricky situation where, you know, maybe you can't look at them, but if later on you can, and because you didn't look at them and didn't preserve them, they no longer exist, it's kind of, you know, the point's moot. So what David wound up doing, and over the span of several long years, is working with the courts to figure out what does the answer to the problem Carrie posed look like. And what it winds up looking like, that sort of they're working on implementing now, because just recently he was granted custody of a copy of the digital records. This was after the standard process of everybody involved in any of those companies, there was a good faith effort made, several good faith efforts made to contact them, ask if they'd like their records pulled or they'd like custody of them back. So in the end, what's left over is considered legally abandoned. And at that point, normally the answer is to destroy it, because it costs money to keep it. So David stepped forward and said, look, if this is abandoned, maybe I can, you know, take custody of it and put it in a private place. So what that winds up looking like is what's called a dark archive. It's an archive you can't look at. And we have examples of these in day-to-day life. If you're a historian and you're interested in looking at census records, you don't get to go, you know, do whatever you want with census records. There's basically a closed room, and you sign certain agreements, and you get to go into the closed room and look at materials, and there's restrictions on what you can take out of that closed room. And so there are both sort of technical mechanisms, you know, the actual room, and there are social mechanisms, legal contracts and things like that, that gate what you can do with the materials. And so the point of all this, to me at least, is that, you know, worries about privacy, to me, as the historian, as the one who like, you know, sheds a tear every single time a historical record dies, you know, I would argue that privacy concerns in themselves, I mean, obviously, if there are things that are particularly sensitive, you know, this is something archivists have dealt with, you know, for way longer. But in the digital realm, you know, there are solutions being worked on to this problem. There are notions of, there's a professor at the University of Maryland, this is one of my favorite solutions to this, because the question is, how do you basically embargo materials? Say, you know, for 50 years from now, I want this to be accessible, but not within, you know, not within the next 50 years. And so he has said, you know, maybe you should, you know, launch it in a capsule that's going to, you know, travel in a certain orbit and then come back in that time. But my favorite solution, and one that actually has a certain elegance to it, is that, you know, based on certain predictions about processor speed and capability, maybe what we do is we encrypt them with an algorithm that will presumably be breakable 50 years from now, but might not. This is just one interesting thought, but there are interesting ideas being batted around as to ways of dealing with these problems.
Well, I guess what I want to do is just ask one more question for the group, for the three of you, and then invite questions. I want to know, and this is something I'm really worried about, is what the future of research is going to look like 10 years, 50 years, and 100 years from now. What's going to survive? What's the stuff going to be like? And how will we be viewing it? So I open this up to anyone who wants to jump in.
I mean, the one thing I'd...
Josh will jump in.
Sorry. The one thing I'd say about that is that, and this is partly me working at the Center for History and New Media and working with other kind of bleeding edge humanists. It's interesting that there's such a term technologically. So one of the big things we've been thinking about is that more and more, a lot of the research questions that are made possible by large-scale databases, by large-scale collections of digital materials, are research problems where you start using algorithmic tools. You do data mining, do visualization, do this kind of stuff. And I think we're going to start seeing these kinds of tools. I mean, I've been involved with this for years now. But these kinds of tools being incorporated into the training of scholars and researchers. So, I think a researcher down the road is going to expect an API that allows them to pull in raw materials, not necessarily framed in, you know, HTML or whatever else, but pull in raw materials that they can then work with, you know, that circulating a material or offering access to it doesn't simply mean, you know, letting you look at it. It means letting you really work with it, and that kind of work, like the number of academics who I've seen who were really excited by, for example, Yahoo Pipes, where you start to put interfaces on these kind of combinatorial and algorithmic tools. It's really exciting to think down the road what kinds of historical questions those will allow us to ask that right now are just simply not within the realm of possibility.
Well, I guess I'm wondering about how much we can trust, how much we'll be able to trust what we see. Let's say that I'll want to do research 50 years from now on funding of arts, and I want to look at the records of an organization like the National Endowment for the Humanities, and I get their email, which has been, you know, migrated along by custodians who are caring for it as archivists, but also as, you know, sort of technology people too. So my trust, the trust that I would have with, you know, the Ransom Center here or the Library of Congress or the New York Public Library, just walking in, I'm pretty sure that the letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote is indeed the letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote. But 50 years from now, that email will have been subject to corruption. And I don't know, my intuition that is that it's going to be spooky and disorienting. The archival record from our time is going to not resemble physically the stuff that we produced. And we're going to have faith in the custodians of that of those records on a whole another level. Do you think that's...
Yeah, but in a sense, we've always had to. I mean, working in an institution that's... Well, if you count our predecessor institutions, you know, we're almost 150 years old, that I have to trust my colleagues from the past that when there's a diary and they say it's a diary written by someone at a certain time, I just have to trust them, because sometimes the internal evidence doesn't actually say that, and maybe the letter that they got with the diary no longer exists. So there is a certain level of trust, and that's why I think institutions like the New York Public Library will always play a role in preserving historical record, because there has to be, first of all, we make the long-term commitment to keep things forever or until Manhattan's underwater.
Even then.
And even then, you know, we'll put on something. Yeah, we'll be able to
breathe
underwater
for that
by then.
And then,
and the fact that when you come in, what we, you know, you trust that what we say something is what it is. And so I'm not I don't know why I'm coming out to be an optimist today, because I'm not.
That's really not.
I have profound problems with life. I think we'll adjust, and I think, you know, someone 50 years from now will obviously be less, you know, thrown off balance by that prospect than we are today. But what we do now will impact that, and I don't know, and we don't really know what we're going to do now, so it's an interesting time.
If people want to start lining up for questions, Megan, do you want to respond to this last?
What was I going to say? About art, again. The problem for me with art and new media art is that when you look at a 500-year-old painting, you know that you're looking at a 500-year-old painting. The varnish is yellowed. It's, you know, got a certain kind of frame on it. It's in a certain kind of building. There, you know, all of these contextual clues about what it is you're looking at. When you're looking at a new media art piece that has been emulated, you can count on the fact that it's changed. I mean, something has changed, but you don't actually know what has changed, and there is no way for you to know what has changed, because there isn't any formal notational language that tells you what's changed. So say you're listening to a Mozart piece, and you can read the score. You know that, for example, this Mozart piece was written for harpsichord and it's being played on piano. Well, you know that, right? Because you can read it on your score. You know that they have, you know, they've changed the timing, or they've put in a crescendo where there isn't one written. You know all of those things just because there's a formal language. And so what I would like to do is develop some sort of formal language for these ephemeral, time-based, network-based pieces, just so you can tell that sort of information. The contextual sort of information.
Great. And our first question is going to come from someone who could actually write that kind of thing for us. But if you could just say your name and where you're from. Tantek, go ahead.
Tantek Celik from San Francisco. So my question is about the past versus the future. We've heard a lot about challenges and difficulties and problems of things rotting in the past, or the things we're trying to archive right now. Looking forward, what key general or even specific recommendation would you give to self-archivers or to anyone trying to preserve their electronic legacy? And second, what are you doing to personally archive your electronic output? What methods and techniques are you using? And third, have you published those techniques in somewhere where the rest of us can reuse them?
I'll just say that I have a messy desk sticker on my thing, so don't look to me for modeling good behavior, but I'm going to let Megan answer that because she's actually done a lot of research in this area.
Yeah, actually, I was a project manager for a project called Managing the Digital University Desktop, MDUD, and the catchy acronym, and one of our end products was a list of guidelines for how to reliably preserve your digital documents. And there are just a number of things. Like, for example, don't keep things that you don't need. Those are really useful ones. Try to use non-proprietary open source software so people can get into it. Mm-hmm. That's a really big one. I recommend that you go to that. Just look up Managing the Digital University Desktop, and then it should be on the front page.
I am from the Library of Congress about the MDIC program. Mm-hmm. And we basically redid our website that has a kind of what you can do section at digitalpreservation.gov. And there's a little section there. We just added last week some new material on just small steps that individual collectors can do, you know, to preserve their collections. And you can also see video of David Kirsch,
it's digitalpreservation.org, right? .gov, sorry. Digitalpreservation.gov from the Library of Congress and Deep website. Yes, next question.
Hi, I'm Terrell Russell. I'm a former colleague of Megan's, still a PhD student at UNC Chapel Hill, Information Library Science. And I just wanted to get your opinion on how, you know, this industry of archiving, this industry of keeping stuff around and dealing with it in a professional way, is it growing? In the past, we've always had a dearth of stuff to, you know, keep. Just hasn't been a lot around, and so now we're going to be flooded. Did I use that word absolutely backwards?
No.
Okay. All right. You know, we're gonna have too much, and so figuring out what it is that we want to keep. Is there just going to be more work in this area? Is the industry growing?
Go ahead, Bill. Yeah.
There's really, I had to disagree with you a little bit because there's really never been enough of us to do what was already to be done in the past already. For instance, where I work, I'm supposed to be documenting New York City and New York State. You know, yeah, right, exactly. And there's maybe four or five institutions that have sort of the same collecting focus. And, you know, it's absurd. I mean, there's no way, there's so many things that we haven't collected that have been lost. I hope, you know, this is an opportunity for us to, because people are seeing it as a new problem, and I don't necessarily see it as a new problem, it's an opportunity for us to get more people doing it, more institutions doing it. My division grows in size, so we have more people doing it so that we can do more. So that's why, once again, I'm pretty optimistic. But I think there are, certainly the use of the word archives has increased dramatically, it's a problem. That's a problem too of terminology. But and I think there are more people interested in going into archives, and I see just things like the talent pool growing and the people going into the profession. So I think yes. Loss is inevitable. And frankly, I was joking when he said he'd cry whenever a record died, and he cries and I clap because there are just too many. There are just too many records out there, but. We want to make sure that people doing significant things save their records and allow the professionals to make the decision as to what to throw out later. But you're right. We need more people doing it, and I think there are more people thinking about it, if not necessarily being paid to do it.
One just thing that I want to tack onto that is, from my perspective, not as anyone who's had any training as an archivist and comes to this shared space from outside the library and information science kind of world. One thing I see is that increasingly now, I think just in the general culture, there's an increasing tendency to be aware of the usefulness of archives, of the past. There seems to be this orientation away from just a purely like the now ephemeral use of things, with an acknowledgement that if you store what you've done over time, that information can be useful to you. And as more and more systems are built that take that historical information and, aggregate it and, come up with something that's a bit greater than the sum of its parts, I think there's this growing sort of, at a minimum at least, acknowledgement of the usefulness of the past. And so that, to me, is a really promising thing towards what you're talking about.
Next question.
Hi, my name is Ben Brumfield, and I'm an amateur working on manuscript transcription software. Mm. My question for the panel is this. What advice would those of you involved in preserving the digital have for those of us involved in sort of the reckless digitization of historical resources and documents?
Yeah, did you hear what he said?
Ooh.
Yeah, well, that's actually... That's a pretty important problem, because one of the things that we're looking at, within this whole field, there are I see three main activities in digital libraries. One is digitization, one is digital preservation, and I can't remember the third one. But it's like we've had this. We've been digitizing our collections, and so we make a master TIFF, and then we have to make an institutional decision about what that master TIFF is. Is it like an archival object that we have the same kind of custodial responsibility for? Or is it something that we could, photograph again or scan again? And it's the original, manuscript that's really what we have to worry about. So I guess it depends, I would say, on how much money you have for storage and migration, how much access you have to the original object, and what your real mission is. And you have to figure, you have to kind of do a cost-benefit analysis and go from there.
One thing that I'd add is that, from my perspective, you can digitize stuff for multiple reasons. There's digitization for preservation.
That's the other one.
In which case, there's a certain set of practices. and you want to master TIFF at as high resolution as possible, and you know there are resources out there to sort of tell you that. In addition to sort of there are archival standards, certain bits of metadata you need, and that so that you know if you handed that archive off to somewhere else that you know had that climate controlled room that could store it really long term. But then the other part is digitization for access. If you just want to let people see it more, and there you have a totally different set of goals. And so, you know, like Carrie was saying, being clear on your mission is incredibly important. If you're just interested in access and circulating things, you have a different set of issues. Now, most people fall somewhere in between, and there are trade-offs you make because there are always limited resources. So it's just a matter of being really clear on what your goals are.
Yeah. Next question.
My name is Melanie Orndorff. I'm from Los Angeles, and part of my background is as a professional organizer, helping people work on their both paper and digital workflow. Mm-hmm. And so I guess my question is, with this trend towards the paperless office and paperless home organization, do you recommend getting rid of all the paper files, or do you recommend keeping a lot of those, given the digital degradation that you're seeing?
Mm-hmm. And Bill, I'm going to let you answer that one.
I guess I wouldn't recommend ever getting rid of the paper. I mean, there's a certain amount of redundancy. I mean, even the September 11th fund collection I was talking about came with about 15 boxes of paper. I have a feeling all of it's replicated in the electronic records as well, but I'm glad to have it. I would say at this point, the thing about paper, obviously, it takes up space. It costs, I don't know if it costs more money, but it costs money in different ways. And we try not to, we don't keep duplicates in archival collections in general, so we would keep one or the other. But it's always, the question always with paper archives is like, why are you keeping this paper to begin with? You know, does it duplicate something else you have? Does it actually add to the documentary story at all? But I wouldn't recommend this, yeah. I mean, the paperless office, I mean, I don't know. Does anyone have a paperless office? I think the question
is a good one because, you know, we're not really in a digital era. We're in a hybrid era, and we will be for a long time. And I think one of the questions, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that, you know, when you have an archival collection, one of the things that historians are going to want to look at is the relationship between objects and being able to understand the context of the original collection. So if in fact there are paper pieces that have significance apart from the stuff that's on the machines, the question is really going to be, you know, how do you understand the whole context of the collection, half of it being in the physical world and the other half of it being in the digital world, I would say.
Right, the paper might say, for instance, tell you what the final version of something was because it's printed out neatly stapled together, and it gives you the clue that all those versions in electronic form, that's the final version, for instance.
I just have to ask, do we have time for one more question?
Not really, but we might move that out in the hallway.
Okay. Okay, thank you very much for your attention.